Hi, you're tuned to Truth News Radio Australia on the 11th of July 2015. My name's Hereward Fenton. Welcome to the show, folks. Well, in today's show, I'm going to be focusing on two main topics. The first will be looking at the situation in Greece. This is something that I feel that I can add something meaningful to the discussion of what's going on in Greece, simply because I have got my eyes open, I'm awake, and I'm not succumbing to the web of deception that the media spins around what is going on. And I simply want to reflect to this audience what I perceive as the real agenda, what's really happening. It's certainly different to the way that the spin is making you think. And the second topic I want to look at today is related to the monumental epochal changes in legislation in the United States at a federal level, which allow, indeed enshrine same-sex marriage as a right right across the country. Now, these changes, which were passed through the Congress in the United States, of course, have had repercussions around the world because the U.S. being the most powerful country on earth, when major laws like that change, there are ripple effects. But I want to look into some of the implications and some of the deeper meanings behind this very, very significant change in law in the United States. And I do emphasize that it is important and it is significant. A lot of people take the position that, oh, look, it doesn't matter, you know, just, you know, it's a waste of time talking about it. You know, whatever people want to do in private, it's their own business and I don't care. And I actually agree with that too. I personally think that whatever consenting adults do in private is really none of my business, although there are extreme cases where consenting adults have actually, you know, eaten each other and things like that, which I don't know. I mean, that's a little bit weird, isn't it? But there are cases like that that have occurred that make you maybe question even the question of consent when it appears that people are doing things that are abominable or abominations. The fact that they consented to it and they were adults doesn't necessarily change certainly the way we feel about it, and I'm not sure about the legal implications of something like, you know, voluntary cannibalism. But anyway, that's a bit of a side topic. First of all, let's return to the case of the Greek referendum and the current situation in Greece. I've got an article here from Vox magazine, and I think it actually summarizes the correct situation, the correct appreciation of what is going on right now. You see, what actually happened is there was a referendum, and the referendum was purportedly to decide whether the Greek people would accept the cruel austerity measures in the bailout proposals that were submitted to Greece from the European banks. And these proposals were rejected. But now the Greek government has turned around and you know, the Greek leadership, with the support of their MPs, has turned around and basically agreed to 90% of all those terms that the people of Greece rejected in the referendum. The article here from Vox is "The New Greek Debt Crisis Question: Can Europe Take Yes for an Answer?" 2 weeks ago, the big question in the Greek debt crisis was whether the Greek government would capitulate to its creditors' demands and get the short-term money it needs to stay in the eurozone. Now, after two dramatic weeks of deadlines and red lines and banking emergency and a referendum, the situation is reversed. Greece's European partners need to decide whether they want to take yes for an answer and keep Greece in the eurozone, or whether they want to find a pretext to say no and try to force Greece out. Where things stand right now, Greece creditors set a Sunday deadline, and that would be a Sunday the 12th of July, for the country to come up with an acceptable set of budget plans and economic reforms, or else have its banking system completely cut off by the European Central Bank. Thursday night, Greece presented a plan that represents a near total surrender on all the relevant points. Rather than give a quick answer, Greece's European partners called for a couple of days' study in advance of a Saturday meeting, essentially guaranteeing that a no verdict on the deal will leave no time for future negotiations. Even though Greece has given in to all of its creditors' important demands, there is a school of thought that says the eurozone will be stronger without Greece. There is also a school of thought that says Greece will be better off leaving the euro. The latest Greek proposal represents an essentially total cave-in by Greece to what its creditors had been demanding. The two main remaining outstanding points of disagreement are essentially trivial. Greece wants to exempt hotels on some small outlying Greek islands from sales tax increases. And Greece wants to implement pension reforms in October rather than right away. If Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras had made this offer in February, the deal would have been sealed immediately, with Europe's creditors jumping for joy. If he had made it as recently as 2 weeks ago, the deal would have been greeted extremely warmly. But over the past 24 hours, many Eurozone finance ministers have sounded sceptical, despite their near total victory on all important matters. Now, I've got a few comments to make about this, right? First is that we have been deceived and the Greek people have been deceived. And this is very, very important to understand, because this will perhaps indicate where this is really headed. You see, in the 21st century, what's happened is that Western civilization has descended into this game of pretend democracy, because it's very important to maintain the illusion that people make decisions about their government, about their lives, about their world, when in fact all the decisions have been made and you have no rights and no freedom whatsoever. So elections, referendums and all this stuff are part of the theatre of democracy. So what we have seen in Greece is a pretense that the people were able to have a say in what is going on, whereas clearly their own government has backtracked on the mandate given by the people in the referendum to reject the bailout proposals. And very interestingly, the finance minister, who was part of this very radical approach and encouraging rejection of the bailout proposals, resigned a day after the referendum. And this, again, fits in with my perception that the plan all along was for Greece to accept the bailout terms, but it was to be done in such a way that that an illusion was created that the people were somehow involved in that they had a referendum, and that then the Greek government, at great cost and with great effort, achieved some concessions from the European Central Banks, and finally they hammered out a deal which everyone could agree with. Of course, it's ludicrous. No one's going to believe that, really. But that is the illusion that will be spun by the media. See, I don't believe, and I may be wrong, but we'll see. We'll soon find out. I don't believe that that Greece will be kicked out of the EU, that Greece will go back to the drachma. I don't think it's feasible. I don't think it's on the table. I don't think it's on the cards. It's just talk. It's just chatter. And basically, all of that talk now is about essentially Europe kicking Greece out, because Greece has now decided that they just will do whatever they need to do, despite their own referendum. So this is something to make us think about what is really going on, what the real plan is, what the real dangers are, if any, to the global financial system. Of course, if Greece did completely default on its debt, that would then put Germany in the firing line. Germany holds most of Greece's debt. So if Greece defaulted on its debt, Germany would be in big trouble. But what I want to really focus on is that what is really going on here is a consolidation of power, rather than an attempt by Greece to free itself from the euro, rather than anything that's going to really transform society in a positive direction. It's a consolidation of power that is going to reduce the sovereignty of the Greek nation. And this is being achieved by holding Greece hostage, by creating a situation where people cannot get their money out of the bank. So what we're looking at is, I believe, a plan which was organized, which was thought through, which was intentional, to create a crisis so that they could further consolidate European power, the pure Hegelian dialectic, problem, reaction, solution. And when the EU authorities finally do agree to Greece's bailout proposal, which are essentially identical to the original ones, when they finally do agree to that, this will then create a domino effect with all the other countries that are in debt. And there will be further consolidations of power of the EU. And this is what we are moving towards in modern Western civilization, is this centralization of power. And it's something that we have to really try to work against. Now, I say that because I believe that centralization of power is the greatest threat to freedom and democracy around the world. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. I hope you're enjoying the show. We'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio Australia, and I'm talking today about the situation in Greece. I want to read another opinion piece from Global Research, again looking into the reality behind the new Greek proposals. I've got an article here titled Greece Black Friday, Blackmailed into Capitulation, Tsipras Austerity Plan. Today's dawning, this is from the 10th of July, so that's from yesterday. Today's dawning divulged a horror scenario. The Syriza government practically capitulated on the demands of the Troika, of the murderous, tyrannical Brussels Parliament. Against the will of the people, Mr. Tsipras and his new finance minister proposed an austerity plan that is almost impossible to be rejected by the Brussels self-denominated emperors of Europe. The crucial point is that Greece still has no plan B, a plan B which most probably in exclusivity call for an immediate exit from the Eurozone. As it is today, hardly anybody dares talking openly about the must of an exit from the Euro, that this is the only salvation, at least salvation that we humans can see in our dimension of life and death. Why is it so difficult? After the events of last night and this morning, the apparent capitulation, it has become ever so clearer that there is something behind what is going on with Brussels, that as usual, the strings are pulled in Washington. Washington is pressing its stooges, Brussels, EC and EU Parliament, through the ECB to not let Greece exit from the Euro, and simultaneously they are threatening Greece not to exit the Euro. There is too much at stake for the US Empire's security, which is global hegemony through NATO, predominantly in Europe. NATO, they fear, may fall apart if Europe and the Eurozone fall apart as a result of a mass exodus that could be triggered through Greece's sovereign decision, the people's overwhelming choice to say no to economic waterboarding of the EU and the corrupt Eurozone. NATO is everything for the US. Together with the US Army, it is the backbone of its economy. More than 50% of it depends on the US military-industrial complex and its related industries and services. NATO is also the constant threatening sledgehammer, hence the violent security branch. NATO is the military instrument to keep the world in check and to ultimately achieve full-spectrum world dominance. So that again is another aspect of this, which I certainly can agree with. The US obviously has, the US power block has a great interest in maintaining the Eurozone power block. But this is what we are seeing the world devolve into, is power blocks. So the North American power block, the Eurozone power block, we see the East Asian power block, we see the Russian power block, and various other countries in the world are pulled in to those blocks. We see a scenario that is very similar to what George Orwell envisioned in 1984. But what's interesting about this is that I think many people don't understand that in a situation such as Greece's, it would actually be possible if there really were a mandate of the people, if the will of the people really was respected, or as we could say, if the people had enough gumption to make it happen, they could do what Iceland did. And they could secede from the EU. They could go back to the drachma. And they could survive. Because Greece still has its own natural economy. People can be productive. We seem to have moved into a concept of humanity in this age where we sort of believe that countries can't survive on their own. We believe people can't survive on their own. We believe everything has to be plugged into larger and larger centralized control. And we don't even want to allow people to like grow vegetables or collect rainwater or do anything that makes them independent. And we see the same thing on the global level, where nations aren't allowed to be independent. And it's the most natural thing in the world for a nation to be able to be independent when it has its own economy of an internal nature. I mean, Greece produces olives and feta cheese, and they have a lot of fish, and they The people have lived there for thousands of years, know how to live there. I mean, it's not as if Greece has suffered from some terrible population explosion, which means it can't feed itself. Greece can feed itself, as can most countries. I mean, a lot of countries do require major imports. We know that. But a country like Greece could manage its own affairs. But the situation has been created where we have to believe that it is only like the empire that can save us. And of course, this applies to Australia equally. You know, Australia is a country which unfortunately is very dependent on its trade relationships, whereas we could be a country moving progressively towards more and more independence. I mean, Australia is a massive country with a huge amount of fertile agricultural land. And if we had government that was representative of the interests of the people, we would see Australia moving more and more towards a country which was self-sufficient, with trade as an important part of the economy, but not simply the export of raw materials being the absolute foundation of the economy without which we fall in a screaming heap, because that's what Australia has become. And with the iron ore price dropping as it has, this has had a devastating effect on the Australian economy. And again, this is just an engineered situation. So a show like this, what I'm doing here, is simply to try to add to this discussion. And hopefully there are many, many people out there who will be able to think about this. And hopefully at some point in the future, we will begin to regain our sense and our independence and our consciousness to require our governments to act in the correct way. Okay, I want to turn now to the subject of same-sex marriage. This is a big topic now in the news globally, of course, since the epochal change in laws in the United States. On June 26th, the Supreme Court ruled that state marriage bans were unconstitutional, meaning that all U.S. states must grant marriage licenses to gay and lesbian couples and recognize marriages that have taken place in other states. And of course, in the wake of that, we saw very strong support from Barack Obama. We saw the White House decorated in rainbow-coloured lights. And there's been reports of many corporate institutions taking on the rainbow colours. Burger King has released a rainbow-coloured promotion for one of its burgers. Disneyland apparently has been regaled in rainbow-coloured lights, all in support of this anti-discrimination position, so that people who are homosexual can feel comfortable about what they do, and as well as getting married. It's about a change in public perceptions, not a new change. Nothing radical has really changed, apart from this specific Supreme Court ruling. But it's a very important moment in history, with the leader of the most powerful nation on earth taking such a strong stand on it. I'll come back right after the break to talk more about that with Truth News Radio Australia. We'll be right back. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. My name's Herewood Fenton. It is a great pleasure to be able to talk to you today. And do check out our website at truthnews.com.au. We've had a bit of a hiatus in shows lately. I've just had a lot of other responsibilities and haven't been able to pump the shows out. And I do really sincerely apologise for those of you who are subscribers. Unfortunately, I don't have a lot of choice in these matters, and the subscription numbers never got to a level that we're able to actually provide enough remuneration to allow me to do the show without doing a lot of other things to bring in the money. Hopefully, I'm planning to get back into doing much more ambitious shows, and hopefully we'll get those subscription numbers back up. I'm very keen to actually move this show towards a video format so we can do regular video interviews, and I think that will bring a lot of viewers to the show. And I do believe that I have something important to offer. I think that there's a perspective here that's in this show that is different to what you'll find from other alternative news sources, which are all important and which I respect. But we need independent voices. So if you're able to get on over to the website and send me a donation, it would be greatly appreciated, or a subscription if you are up to that. I would greatly, greatly appreciate it. Now, getting back to this question of gay marriage, I began there talking about the changes in law after the Supreme Court ruling in the United States. And, of course, this is having a ripple effect around the world, and it's bringing a lot more attention to same-sex issues and anti-discrimination and all this kind of stuff. Now, I'm a great supporter of freedom, and I believe people should be free to essentially do what they want. Of course, there are caveats on that. We don't coerce children into behavior. Children are protected, right? That's why there are laws against pedophilia, because children are too young to be able to give consent to many things, not just sex. Children can't vote, right? And it is our duty to protect children. Children are not sexually mature. Another reason why there is very strong moral and legal restrictions against what you may do with children. But two adult people of the same gender engaging in sexual activity, well, I certainly have no problem with that. And indeed, laws have been enshrined in many countries to protect gay people and to protect them from vilification. And again, I agree with that. And the latest stage in all of that has been the movement towards normalizing marriage between same-sex couples. Now, from one perspective, if you examine all this from the perspective of the left, of the fashionable, I would say, dogmas of the left, all of this sounds fine. All of this sounds completely good and right. And I'm neither of the left or the right, but I simply observe that the left has a certain view of this, that the conservatives have another view on it. Because conservative people tend to adhere to traditional views of behaviour, and they see certain things as right and wrong, and they see that people were brought on this earth for a reason, and that marriage is an institution of man and woman for the production of children. Now, many conservative people are not anti-gay. That they don't want to persecute gay people, and they don't want to deny gay people basic rights. But they wish to preserve the traditional nature of the institution of marriage. Now, there are many libertarians who simply take the position that something like the institution of marriage should not be under the governance of the state whatsoever, that the institution of marriage is a private thing that is managed by churches, that is a community thing. It is not necessarily a state institution whatsoever. And I kind of lean towards that view as well. I think that actually has a lot of sense. And I see that there are significant problems with the state kind of taking the mantle of upholding these changes to marriage, because it actually gives the state far too much importance in all this. Because marriage, as a civil institution, really adds nothing to all of the rights and privileges that people already have under common law. For example, even without the institution of marriage, if a gay couple come together and live together as a de facto couple, all the normal rights of those couples apply. It is treated legally exactly the same as marriage. And that applies to heterosexuals as well as gay people. The marriage institution is really just a ceremonial thing, but one which has somehow become intertwined with the mechanism of governance of the state. Now, the fact that this has happened and the fact that the state has now championed this new form of the institution of marriage, this is going to create conflict. There is no doubt that this is going to create conflict, because churches still want to have their traditional way of defining that term and of conducting what they call a marriage. Churches do not want to be forced into a position where they will have to sanctify a marriage between a man and a man, or a woman and a woman. And of course, this hasn't happened yet. It hasn't happened, but the door is open for it to happen. I mean, there have been famous cases of discrimination. For example, there was one where a cake maker was required to make a cake for a gay couple that contained gay themes, and the cake maker refused to make the cake, and that cake maker was sued under anti-discrimination legislation. The same thing could end up happening in churches. The same thing could end up happening in various countries as a result of these sweeping changes that are moving through. Now, that's one thing to be a little concerned about, because it's divisive in terms of society. I mean, the solution that is put forward by the radical secularist left-wing adherents is that, well, this all has to change. And, of course, a lot of people who are atheistic inclined simply think, oh, well, the church has to be swept out, that these changes are we're moving towards a whole new type of society. And you know, this is where I start to think, you know, maybe we do have a problem here. Maybe we do have a problem here. Because what type of society is it that we are moving towards? It appears to be one where the family, as the unit of social cohesion, is replaced by the social construct of the individual in relation to the state, and that the state effectively becomes a parent figure. This, again, is another symptom and an indication of a deliberate agenda of people who wield the power in society and who own 99.99% of all the wealth in society, that they are moving us towards a totalitarian system. And isn't it incredible that this can happen in the guise of something that sounds wonderful and kind and decent, such as granting marriage rights to same-sex couples? Now, when we come back from the break, I want to talk about the dreaded concept of pedophilia, very difficult subject. We'll be coming right back. Stay with us.
What happens in terms of creating wars is a mind manipulation technique called problem reaction solution. And it works like this. First of all, you create the problem, but you get someone else to be blamed for it. You then report that problem through the media in the way you want it reported. You get the public to react to your problem by saying, something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do about it? And at
that point, hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia, and I'm talking about same-sex marriage, and I'm now also about to talk about pedophilia. And this is a very dangerous topic to embark on because people in the past have been taken to the courts for vilification simply for associating pedophilia with homosexuality. And let me make it very clear. I do not wish to associate pedophilia with homosexuality, and I totally respect the rights of homosexual people. However, there are some important questions in the public interest which we now need to talk about. There has been a lot of talk on the internet, a lot of posts on Facebook, some of which are correct, some of which are exaggerated. The basic theme being this, that there is a movement similar to the gay rights movement that says, that's a kind of an activist movement that says that just like sexual orientation of gay people is something that society first objected to and then gradually became accustomed to, the sexual orientation of adults towards children is a similar type of thing, and that over time society will and should move toward acceptance of a pedophilic sexual orientations of adults. Now, there have been some cases where this has actually been discussed, and there have been some academic articles, one or two barristers and a judge have said something somewhat along those lines, but I think it is a very long stretch to say that there is any kind of movement to make this a reality. So I want to kind of throw cold water on that because I don't think it's correct. However, there are some things that need to be addressed. And firstly, I want to talk about the American Psychiatric Association and the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, where in fact, in one of the discussions on pedophilia, which they define as pedophilic disorder, in their actual documentation, in their actual book, they did actually use the phrase sexual orientation. Now, they have since backtracked on that, and they have changed the wording in their publication to remove sexual orientation from the DSM, and they have insisted that I've got the quote here from the APA. The American Psychiatric Association, Psychiatric Association has stated, in the case of pedophilic disorder, the disorder name was changed from pedophilia to pedophilic disorder to maintain consistency. Sexual orientation is not a term used in the diagnostic criteria for pedophilic disorder, and its use in the DSM-5 text discussion is an error and should read sexual interest. In fact, APA considers pedophilic disorder a paraphilia, not a sexual orientation. APA stands firmly behind efforts to criminally prosecute those who sexually abuse and exploit children and adolescents. We also support continued efforts to develop treatments for those with pedophilic disorder with the goal of preventing future acts of abuse. Okay, well, that is a very comforting statement to read from the American Psychiatric Association, that they do stand firmly behind criminal prosecution for pedophiles, and they do not acknowledge that pedophilia is a sexual orientation. But it also raises a number of questions. I mean, they make a distinction in that press release between what they call sexual interest and sexual orientation. Now, one could argue, and, you know, a legal person could have a field day with this, and say, well, what is really the difference between sexual interest and orientation? It's just a nuance of language. It's splitting hairs. I mean, there's no doubt that pedophiles are oriented towards children. They like children. They don't just, you know, like them in a friendship way. They like them in a sexual way. They're interested in children sexually. Normal heterosexual people are interested in adults. They're oriented towards adults. They're interested in adults. It's just they're two words that mean really the same thing. And I think it's a rather cheap way of getting out of the problem to simply use a nuance of language and then say, oh, see, we've solved it all now. It's just interest versus orientation. It hasn't answered the question. It hasn't solved the problem. And this is going to keep coming back, because we need to look at this squarely, and we need to separate the issues of legality, which have to do with consent, from the issues of psychology or psychopathology of an individual. What do I mean by that? Well, there are all kinds of sexual fetishes and obsessions, most of which are not illegal. I mean, there are people who fetishize and obsess about having sex with amputees. Now, there's nothing illegal about having sex with an amputee if it's an adult and it's consensual. You know, it's decidedly weird. It's abnormal. But it's totally legal. I'm not absolutely sure what the laws are in regard to sex with animals, and I don't have time in this show to get into that. But again, we don't see a lot of prosecutions of people for buggery. And I'm not even sure what the question of consent is with an animal, whether an animal is capable of giving consent. Perhaps that's a topic for another show. But what I clearly want to focus on in this show is that the reason why pedophilia is illegal is because a child cannot give consent. It is not illegal to have pedophilic thoughts. See, and that would be an Orwellian kind of situation, wouldn't it, where you had like a thought police that could monitor your thoughts. But of course it is illegal to download images of child pornography. So it's a very subtle line there. But the point here to focus, and it's very easy to go off track with this, the point here to focus is that the reason why pedophilia is illegal is because children cannot give consent. Not because thoughts or desires to have sex with children are illegal, because desires are not illegal, only actions. So let's go back to the DSM, let's go back to the American Psychiatric Association and ask them, why is it that you don't think that people who have sexual interest, that adults who have sexual interest in children, have an orientation to children? They clearly do. How can you say that in one case, with homosexuals, it's an orientation, and in the case of pedophiles, it's an abnormality? I believe we have a big legal problem coming, and this will be challenged legally. I mean, I'm not advocating this. I'm not saying I want it to be challenged. And I'm not saying I don't want it to be challenged. I'm just saying the challenge is there in the fine print because of the grey area and the ambiguity. It will be challenged. And there are many, many pedophiles in our society who believe that it's okay. There really are. And most of them are under the radar. Occasionally they pop their heads up. They would like it to be normalized. There have been societies in the past that engaged in pedophilia. There are famous cases in anthropology of societies in New Guinea and I believe in ancient Greece. Again, another topic for another show. But it is quite possible to envision a society in the future where pedophilia is normalized. Now, I think that would be a terrible thing, right? Not just because I have a traditional view of things and I think it's terrible, and not just because of a knee-jerk reaction. I also see this as part of a destruction of the natural organic family unit, which is part of the formation of this totalitarian superstate. I can see a totalitarian superstate wherein pedophilia is actually acknowledged. Because it further erodes the tendencies of families to really bond together as units and for the children to be raised to be strong, independent adults. It basically weakens everybody. So those are just a few thoughts to mull over. I'm going to do more shows on this, and I really do want to get into some of the propaganda that goes with this movement towards acceptance of gay, transgender themes, because a lot of it is going to be harnessed by those who are part of a darker agenda. But I don't believe that gay people are at fault here. I believe that there is something else going on and that this is actually being used. That's our show for this week. We will be back next week. Look forward to speaking to you then. Truth News Radio Australia, signing out.